Hello, I'm Eric Holdeman, and this is Disaster Zone, a podcast about emergencies and disasters. Disaster Zone will bring you interviews and commentaries about all aspects of disasters, from what causes them to how people and organizations are dealing with their impact. Today's podcast is being sponsored by The Blue Cell.
As the nation's most active in-person and virtual incident command system and consequence management training company, stop by our website today to address your personal and agency training needs. Go to www.thebluecell.com.
Welcome to the Disaster Zone podcast. With me today is Mike Byrne. He is a specialist executive working on all aspects of disaster preparedness, mitigation, response, and recovery for Deloitte. With this podcast, we'll be asking Mike about his personal lessons learned from four significant disasters that have impacted the United States. Mike, welcome to the show.
Eric, it's great to be with you. And I have to say, it's been great to be a colleague of yours for I shudder to think, but it's almost 20 years now you and I have worked together.
That's correct. We first met on Top Off 2, where you were the, I think, principal federal official, and I was the King County Emergency Management Director, and we went through that whole deal.
Yeah.
And the rest is history.
The rest is history. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Well, Mike, to begin with, give our audience a quick summary of your background in emergency management, homeland security. It's really been pretty extensive.
Well, great. Thanks, Eric. I'm very proud to say that I spent my first 20 years in emergency work with the New York City Fire Department. I was a firefighter, lieutenant, captain, and spent 20 years there. During that time, though, during my last 5 years, the city, Mayor Giuliani, created the Office of Emergency Management in New York City in 1996. And I had the privilege of being first deputy director there and during the creation of that. And that's kind of where I got introduced to emergency management. And then in 1999, when I retired from the New York City Fire Department, I started a job at FEMA. I felt like a natural progression to, the body can only run into burning buildings so many years, and then it's time to get a job that it still keeps you in the fight, but is more thinking and coordinating than it is hands-on firefighting. So I spent during those next 20 years, I spent 12 of those years with FEMA, but I was in and out. As you know, we've stayed close over the years. But I was, and we'll talk about 9/11, but I also spent some time working for Microsoft. I spent about 3 years there working on public safety applications with Microsoft. And then I spent a number of years in talk about this too with ICF as a consulting firm doing some projects after Katrina. I then came back to FEMA. I couldn't stay away a couple of times and then ended up spending probably from 2010 through to now with FEMA with one brief sojourn with the American Red Cross, where I spent a couple of years as their disaster executive for the Pacific.
Okay, like I say, a lot of different experiences, but we're going to talk about four specific disasters that I would think three of the four will absolutely be nationally and internationally known. So why don't we dive into that? And the first one of those is the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. And this is early in your FEMA career, so explain what your position was. And what Mike's going to talk about is his personal lessons learned from each one of these events. Not the organizational things, but his ahas that then, like all of us, we try to apply to our future work and experience.
So, oh, great. Well, 9/11 of the ones we're going to talk about is probably the toughest personally for me because it was my city, and it was I had only been out of the fire department a little over 2 years, and obviously I knew a lot of the firefighters and the personnel that were directly impacted by the event. So it was it's still an emotional issue for me, but I do think that we all learned a lot, but I did learn a lot too, personally. 2 years at FEMA was just enough time, I think, for me to really get a sense, hands-on, of how the federal government supports locals. And to be able, knowing where, what buttons to push, how to get access, how to bring in the expertise that would be relevant. And that combined with the fact that the leadership of police, fire, EMS, even to the mayor's office, was all people I knew personally. That was just priceless. When I showed up and I was, I was the operations section chief, so I was running all of the tactical stuff that the federal government brought in, whether it was DOD, urban search and rescue, disaster programs that FEMA does, emergency protective measures and all of that. And knowing that side of it and being able to integrate it into, my former colleagues who I all knew personally, just it helped tremendously, obviously, to walk into a room and be recognized as somebody. In fact, I remember the comment I got most was, "Mike, what are you doing here? I thought you retired,"
Yeah.
And it was, "Oh no, I'm in a new job, and I'm your federal contact. What can we do to help?" And that really made a tremendous difference to the operations. I did spend 2 months at Ground Zero working with this, and then as you know, I got recruited to join what was being created at the time was the Office of Homeland Security in the White House. Personally, I can remember going down to Washington and interviewing with the team there, and in particular with Governor Ridge, who is just one of the best leaders I've ever had the privilege of working for. And I've been blessed in the people that I've been able to work for. And I felt so out of place. You know, 1 minute you're in dirty boots at the site of 9/11, and the next you're standing in a suit in the West Wing. And I have to tell you, it was intimidating from a personal level. But Ridge and White House staff, including the president at the time, just made you feel valued, made you feel, and as a lesson learned for other emergency managers, is if you bring your game and you bring your experience to leaders like that, they respect it and they rely on you. And that's probably one of the biggest lessons I learned while during my time in the White House. And as you said, I won't get into all the policy things we did. And you and I could have had many interesting conversations around some of the decisions that were made. But I would say that they do rely on you. They trust you. Governor Ridge, trusted my experience, trusted my relationships with the emergency management community. And as a result, I'd like to think that we did some good and some initiatives that have lasted and survived, the National Incident Management System probably being the most significant thing that came out of the post 9/11 era.
Well, how about, thinking about 9/11, maybe you remember the exact number of firefighters who died on that day. Do you? It was significant.
Yeah, it was 343.
Yeah. So, many emergency managers, where the disaster happens, it happens where they live. So, and a lot of times they themselves, their home is flooded, it's hit by a tornado. I mean, they become part of that. So how did you separate out your, and maybe you can't, I don't know, your personal involvement with the job aspect of it? Or did you have to do that later? I don't know.
I I'm glad you asked me that question. And I would say that in so many ways, I was lucky that I was so busy that I, you know, there wasn't time to think about. Like, I can remember a former colleague of mine, the chief exec to the fire commission at the time, Ray, and he said, "Mike, I've got the list of who's missing. Do you want to see it?" And I remember pausing and initially really wanting to look at it, and then I said, "No, I don't want to look at it because I don't want to spend time thinking about that right now when I have, you know, important things to do." But I'll tell you, for all of the you know, potential, you know, emotional roller coaster of it for me, I would say the other group you got to be concerned about is your family. Again, this incident being so personal, you know, my next door neighbor where I lived, Lieutenant Pete Freund, he died on 9/11. And, you know, I give greater credit to my wife who went next door and helped the widow and her little, she had three little children, and it was supportive to her, and the emotional roller coaster that must have been far greater than any emotional impact it had on me, because I was busy. And then especially 2 months after it going to the White House, you know, that was the hardest I think I've ever worked in my life. And, you know, I've worked some pretty tough assignments, but that one, you know, working post 9/11 in the White House with all of the things that we were doing, the threat environment that continued, the stress around that was very, very intense. But again, I you know, you got to think not just about yourself. Certainly, you need to take care of yourself, but your family, because it's impacting them, and you got to pay attention to that.
Okay, all good tips, and I'll just share one quick story you shared with me. You know, we're about to start the next grant cycle and all that. And all these funds in the majority started flowing after 9/11. State Homeland Security Program funds, they might have had a different name back then. But Mike was the guy who pitched the number to then President George Bush in the Oval Office. I remember, Mike, you told me, it was like $3.2 billion program. And the president asked you, "Is that enough?" And you said, "What'd you say?"
I said, "It's about all I think the system can handle right now."
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you know, when you're talking about those lofty numbers, trillions of dollars and that might not sound like a lot, but sometimes you can shove out too much money. Even at $3.2 billion, I'm not saying any was wasted, but it was a lot of money to spend when you haven't had that type of resource in the past.
Yeah, and especially because the pipeline, you know, like you have to establish pipelines, you know, as your listeners are well aware, every grant has its own process and checks and balances. And we didn't have a lot of that in place. The previous annual, you know, state and local investment was about $100 million. So to go from $100 million a year to $3.4 billion a year, and it stayed at that number for at least 3 years, was a lot for the system to take, but I think it made a difference. I think it certainly sent a message to local police, fire chiefs, and emergency medical folks, and emergency managers that the lack of investment was no longer the case. The nation was going to invest and was going to do whatever it took to build capacity.
Okay. Well, let's go on. Actually, it's a bookend type event, I think. We took a hard right turn towards terrorism on 9/11. And the event that yanked the pendulum back from a terrorism-centric approach to homeland security and emergency management was the 2005 Hurricane Katrina. And explain your involvement with that, and then again, what you learned from it. Now, in this, you're no longer a government official, but in the private sector.
Sure. Well, when Katrina actually hit, I was still working for Microsoft, and I did go to New Orleans and Microsoft, we did some pro bono work to help with the IT systems in New Orleans for the New Orleans government. But I have to tell you, again, since you're asking me for personal reflections, what that taught me was when you're not in it, when you're not in a position where you can provide a direct access and you're kind of on the outside, which happens when, you know, people like us go to the private sector, I was miserable. I was not in the fight. I was positively, there was no living with me at that time because I felt like, you know, geez, I got to get in there and help my friends, my colleagues, and New Orleans.
Yeah, you're a fifth wheel, right?
Yeah, exactly when that happened. So you got to be prepared for that emotionally. But I also took some action. I did leave Microsoft and I went to a company called firm called ICF, which you know well, and we ended up getting hired to about a year in, is a year after the storm hit, where we were hired to manage a $10 billion HUD program to restore housing.
Okay, and so we're trying to be acronym free, and not everybody's a government. Okay. So HUD is
Housing and Urban Development, and they have a funding system called the Community Development Block Grants that where $10 billion was awarded to the state of Louisiana to create a housing program to restore. These are single family housings. That was the main focus of that. We did a little bit of multifamily, but the vast majority of the funds was for single family dwellings that where the FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency's funding post-disaster was not sufficient to get the families back in their homes.
Okay. And one of your experiences in that is dealing with the media in New Orleans. You kind of walked around with a target on your back as this contractor doing this work. I want to say that you sold more newspapers for the Picayune News than anybody. So explain that. I mean, it probably was not a self-generated negative relationship, but they made it that maybe. That's my impression. How did you deal with that?
Well, first of all, just so the listeners, the program is called The Road Home, and it actually was on statistically, it was actually very successful. We ended up helping 135,000 families get their get back into their homes or build new homes or move out of the floodplain. We did all of those things, and it was really a positive impact. But you're absolutely right. It was a very tough because I think the nation and in particular the people of Louisiana were angry. And they were angry for good reason that this storm and the levee breaking really did a lot of damage, and it exposed some of the shortfalls of our systems and what the kind of assistance that we can bring and the coordination that we can bring. And obviously a lot changed after that. There was legislation, there was these grant programs, but because there was that anger there, I guess one of my hard and fast rules of emergency management is twofold. Is one is you can never give people enough money, and number two is you can never give it to them fast enough. And that second one was the really tough one because you have to be responsible and be a good steward of government dollars, and you have to put protocols in place. You have to put checks and balances, and those take time. And because of that, that created a lot of bad press, and in our business, if you're going to be in this business, you got to be prepared to take that. Not only was in fact the I did an editorial board with the Times-Picayune, and after it it was a I think the Picayune was a family-owned paper, so the patriarch of the family happened to be in the office and he wanted to see me. Well, the guy comes out and he gives me a hug and he says, "Mike, you're selling more papers for me than anybody since Katrina." I said, "Well, I'm glad I'm making you happy because I'm not making too many other people happy." But I'm proud of the work we did there. I'm certainly proud of the people that worked with me. I had incredibly dedicated, talented people. I mean, we hired 2,000 people in the, over the course of 60 days to get this program up and running. We opened 12 offices across the state. I'm very proud of the work we did. And I learned a valuable lesson. I learned that you gotta have a thick skin, and you gotta be, you can't let it get you angry. And actually I'll share one other thing about anger, you know, because sometimes you will get angry in this business because you think you're being either treated unfairly or the circumstances according to that. And I've been blessed to have good leaders before that taught me, but I've also had executive coaches a couple of times. And it was in particular this time where the executive coach I had at the time said to me, "Hey, Mike, what do you think your biggest challenge is?" I said, "Well, I said I find myself getting angry, you know, sometimes. I find myself being upset at what's going on around me and the way people are treating me." And so she asked me, she said, "Well, what do you think the cause of that is?" "Well, obviously, it's because I'm right and they're wrong." And so she just laughed at me and said, "So how's that working for you?" And obviously it wasn't working really well. And then she told me probably the best piece of advice that I've ever had as a manager and a leader. And that is, "You know what the source of anger is?" I said, "Obviously, no, I don't." And she said, "It's fear. So what I'm going to ask you to do is every time you feel yourself getting angry, pause and count to 10 and ask yourself, what are you afraid of? What is causing this reaction?" And I will tell you, I haven't been perfect at it. I certainly have failed to count to 10 sometimes, but that has helped me more as I've gone on in my career than probably any other piece of advice I've ever gotten.
You know, you just made me think about something. And I had, you see a dog who kind of attacks. My sister had one. Any bicycle, tricycle, wheelchair would go by that dog, Rosie, an Irish setter. She would attack, and she was afraid, you know, she was afraid. Yeah. She must have at a puppy level been somehow surprised and fearful. So out of fear, sometimes we attack. So maybe we are like dogs.
That's true.
Break
That's
our
true.
Bad habits.
Yeah, and Eric, just so it wasn't all bad in Lewis.
Oh yeah, I know.
Two quick stories I'll share. One is I testified in front of the Joint Budget Committee of the Louisiana Legislature on a regular basis, and that was also not a pleasant experience, I'll have to say, but it was just amazing. The legislators would be friendly and chat with me before and after it, but during the session, you know, they let you have it, and that's their job, and you got to realize it's their job. But there was one particular intense session where I come out of it, and the sergeant of arms of the committee, who I'd gotten to know, obviously, because I was there so much, he comes up to me, and he comes over to me, and he looks behind me, and he says, "Mike," he says, "I don't know what you're worried about." He says, "You still got some more butt to chew." Oh, that, only in Louisiana would I hear that. And then I guess one other one is, which is, I'll remember always. I did a lot of town halls, and that's the other thing. Even though you get in bed, you know, press and people are angry, and you've got to give them a way to get to you and to talk to you and to be face to face. You've got to have the stamina to do that. So I did a lot of town hall meetings, and one in particular was in a town called Erath, and that had been significantly impacted by the storm. And the kind of leader, the informal leader of that community, was the Monsignor of the Catholic Church. And we did the session, and there was about 400 people in the audience in the church. And he started it off by reminding everybody where they were and they needed to behave themselves, okay? And it went on for many, many hours where I took all the questions until finally he came up and he says, "Ladies and gentlemen," he says, I want us all to thank this, you know, gentleman for his time and for his information. And now we're going to treat him to a fine Louisiana dinner over at the rectory." And that really, you know, like it was a tough meeting. I took a lot of shots, but the fact that at the end of it, we all sat down and broke bread together, and we realized that we had a common purpose. That really warmed my heart and made me realize that what we do in emergency management at whatever level is a noble mission.
Okay, one more dog story. I remember you talking about that road home with dog ears in your life. So.
Yeah, that's right.
But, you know, there's always light at the end of the tunnel. Right? So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Listen, we're only halfway through here. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back. Today's podcast is being sponsored by The Blue Cell.
As the nation's most active in-person and virtual incident command system and consequence management training company, stop by our website today to address your personal and agency training needs. Go to www.thebluecell.com.
Okay, and welcome back. We're talking to Michael Byrne, goes by Mike with Deloitte Consulting, and he is a disaster expert and a response and recovery expert, if ever there was one. And we've got two more disasters to talk about. And next one that I'm not familiar with, at least it is not burned into my memory, is the 2011 Alabama tornado outbreak. What was your role there, and what did you learn, Mike?
Well, this was it was April 27th, 2011, and it was a night that I think everyone in Alabama will always remember, and because I think it was 65 tornado strikes burnt through the state and killed some 262 people. And injured many, many more and destroyed lots and lots of property. And it was an incredibly intense event. I was deployed. I was the leader of the National Incident Management Assistance Team, which those of us who, you know, at FEMA, there are each of the 10 FEMA regions has either one or more incident management assistance teams, and then there's three national teams. And the national team's job is not to go to the more routine events, and it's always a little awkward to talk about emergencies as routine, but there are some that we've been through many times, and we've got...
I call it the flood, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I mean, it's... But I always, you know... worry about saying that because to the person that's impacted, it's the biggest event they've ever had in their lives. So, but anyway, this was a big event. So one of the national teams, my team, was deployed to Alabama. The command center's in Clanton, Alabama. And we were there to provide federal support. It was there that I got to work with for the first time, somebody who I really admire, Jeff Byard, who went on to be the Associate Administrator for Response Recovery at FEMA during the last administration, and also is now with Team Rubicon, managing, you know, still staying in the game and helping people. But probably part, you know, one of the best emergency managers I ever worked with. And I had experience in Alabama before. Another mentor of mine and kind of legend in emergency management, Bruce Bauman, had been the state director there. So I knew the state, not as well as I was gonna come to learn it, but it was a tough event and very emotional event for people. A lot of people lost their homes and a lot of people unfortunately lost their lives. I'd say that the lessons I've learned from that one is again about collaboration. If there is anything in this business, And I would say in the private sector too, it's all about your ability to coordinate, your ability to network, to connect with people, to build those relationships. You know, the often used phrase of you don't want to exchange business cards at an event is valid. You know, you should do everything you can to know your business, know your industry, and actually that brings me to you know, another, I guess, personal view of this. Again, one of the most powerful mentors I ever had was a fellow by the name of Bill Feehan. Bill Feehan was first deputy fire commissioner in the city of New York, and unfortunately he died on 9/11. But I like to share this story because I feel like I'm paying his leadership forward, and that he had a three-word phrase that guided his actions. It was commitment, compassion, and courage, the three C's. And he talked about commitment, which is to know your job. And that's what I was just talking about. To know your job, make the connections, reach out. Don't, you know, just sit and think on your own. But, you know, emergency management, it's all about integration and coordination and allowing, creating an environment where everyone gets to bring their A game and gets to do what they have trained for and are committed to do. Your job is to create the environment to welcome them and to make sure that they're getting a chance to execute. The concept of compassion, Bill was very, very insistent on, it's not just compassion for the survivors and the people impacted by whatever, you know, emergency or disaster event, which we, you know, I think we intuitively do, you know, it's instinctual that we do it, but also to look back on the rest of your colleagues and bring that same compassion, because what we do is not the easiest thing in the world to do sometimes. And it does take an emotional toll on all of us, and that we need to bring that compassion and empathy to each other as we're working together. And then lastly, courage. I'll tell you again, you know, just have the courage to empower your team and empower your things. And I was told by Bill, and I passed it on, that if you see an opportunity to make a difference and to reduce suffering or save a life, okay, that, and you, for all you know, and notice how I phrase that, because I've been around lawyers now, that for all you know, it's legal, okay, and you have the ability and the capability to do it, don't ask for permission. Just go ahead and do it. And I would say that has, you know, stead me well in my career. Not always worked out, but for the most part, it helped out. So,
yeah, the last one's kind of ask for forgiveness if you have to. Right?
That's it.
And, act.
And a good boss will get that and realize that, there's over the years, there's a whole bunch of phrases I carry around, and I'm sure you do, and all our listeners do too. But, you know, one of them is, you want to be right or you want to be successful. I'll take successful every time. I don't have to be perfect every time, but let's move forward. And then one other one is, when you get to yes, shut up and get up and leave the room, because if you keep talking about it, you will find a way to get to know.
Right. You know, just I'm going to go backwards on you. You talked about going to the White House, and as the White House Office of Homeland Security, before as a department, you joined there, and the respect for your knowledge and everything that was given. When you talked about courage now, I was thinking about sometimes you go into positions, or people listen to this now, you know, the leadership, elected leadership, perhaps senior appointed officials, don't respect your knowledge. I've been in a number of positions like that, and I always thought it was my job to make sure that they had the best information possible, even though I knew they didn't want to hear it. And I think that takes courage. Any thought on that? For people in a work environment where the boss doesn't want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I you know, and that's probably one of the toughest things that you can run into. There's a other colleague of mine that I worked with at FEMA, and he had an expression where he says, "Bad news doesn't get better with time."
That's right.
Yes. And again, you have to have the courage to bring it up, and recognize that everybody is at a different place on their leadership education or maturation curve, right? And sometimes you're going to have to share that with somebody who's not a good recipient of it. You got to separate the emotion. You know, we talked about, you got to separate the emotion, because it's not about you. It's not about the individual you're giving that information to. It's about the people that are suffering. And I think that if you focus on that and you bring the discussion to the impact and the outcomes and the consequences of what you're talking about and what you're bringing to this person in leadership, and don't let the vitriol or even the intensity that they're coming at you with, or the disregard and the don't let that get in the way. Our responsibility is to the people that we serve, and you have to focus on that. The other thing that I would say in dealing with individuals like that, and this is one of the best books I ever read, and I think I first read it back in 1990, was Getting to Yes by the Harvey Kennedy School of Negotiations. And it really emphasizes the idea that you don't start with the most difficult issues in order to build a relationship with somebody. Because a lot of times the reason you're getting that is because you haven't really worked and you haven't established that mutual respect. Is to don't work on the most difficult thing first. And all of us seem to think that, I got to solve the most difficult one, because if I don't solve that, this whole thing will collapse. No, don't. Leave the most difficult. Solve a couple of easy ones together. Build trust. Build a respect for each other. And then you then attack the most difficult ones. And I'm not saying it's not going to be tough to solve it, but it'll certainly be a more collaborative environment going forward.
Okay. Good advice. Well, our fourth last disaster to talk about, and you've had some tough ones in your history that we've talked about already, but Hurricane Maria and Puerto Rico. What was your involvement there? I want to say you came in as part of recovery, but even when you came in, there was a response aspect to it. So explain your role and what you learned from it.
Sure. I was actually in Texas when the call came. I was working Harvey, because Hurricane Harvey had hit Texas, and I wasn't in charge yet, but I was supporting. I was the recovery person to support the region and the state. And it was about 2 weeks after the storm hit that I got sent to Puerto Rico, and I think it was a reflection of that. You're right. We were still very much in response. There was no recovery activity going on when I got there. It was very much response. The situation was, one of the things I found interesting is that this is where I feel so blessed to have worked in for a company like Microsoft and worked in IT is the idea, the four elements of big data. Velocity, volume, veracity, and variety, the four Vs, and that make big data the challenge it is to turn into useful information, is the same in disasters. The velocity at which incidents are coming. And I will tell you, in Puerto Rico, when I got there, we could not manage the incoming request for assistance. We were certainly close to being overwhelmed. And this is even though, at this point in time, we were bringing in all kinds of additional assets. Once I was there about a month, I think I was up to about 20,000 soldiers, sailors, civilians, all working to help Puerto Rico.
And you were at FEMA. You were at FEMA.
Yeah, I was at FEMA. I was actually at the time I was the assistant administrator for field operations, but they said, Mike, put that on pause. Get down there and help out, and I felt lucky to be there and to do that. So the velocity, the speed with which they're coming at you, in addition to the volume of them, the veracity. It's hard to separate this is the challenge of what we do, the reality, or the rumors, you're going to have to still make decisions even with the ambiguity in those spaces. And then, of course, the variety, the different kinds of assistance, whether it's food, it's shelter, it's a road out, it's medical, it's all
electrical power.
Electrical, oh, God, don't bring that back. I'm having a heart attack here. But and it took us almost a year to get all the power back. It was a devastating hurricane. And there's been a lot of, positive things said about the response, a lot of negative things about the response. But I would tell you, I did an interview with Frontline, and they were really hammering us on our execution. And I discovered, and this is again for our colleagues in emergency management, I discovered that a lot of times, people are looking for a villain. They're looking for somebody to blame this bad thing on, okay? And you're an easy target because you're there trying to help. And during the interview, I kind of reached a point where I really felt that coming to me. And I finally said to the reporter that was interviewing me, I said, if you're looking for a villain, the villain was the 150 mile an hour winds and the 30 inches of rain over 3 days. That's what caused all this pain. You know, we'll look back and figure out all of the things we could have done ahead of time and stuff like that. But I said it because I really needed my team to know that they had the respect of both myself and the nation. And I said, every single person here that is working as part of the response and recovery operation is here for one reason, and that is to try to reduce suffering and to turn things around. And that has to be respected. And I think I encourage all of us in the industry to recognize that and recognize that it's only natural for us as human beings to look for the villain. You keep your team focused on the real villain, which is the disaster that happened.
And you know, you're so right in that sometimes the villain is an agency. You know, FEMA's had that in Hurricane Katrina, but still news media and individuals, they do want to personalize it. They're looking for the individual, and when you're the leader, you become the focus of that. And you know, I've talked to a number of emergency managers, and their program managers or coordinators, and they, I said, well, how you could become a director, and they say, oh no, that's too political. How would you answer them? I've got an answer, but get out of the kitchen if you don't, don't turn on the oven if you don't want to bake something. But how do you answer that? You know, if you're going to be in a leadership position, the political aspect of it.
Life is political. Everything, personal relationships are political. The phrase, it's too political. I'm with you. Don't think about that. Think about the nobility of the mission. There are a few opportunities in our lives where we get to have a direct, and I mean direct impact, to make life better for somebody who's going through what may well be the most horrific moment. I'm again lucky that I got that drilled into me as a young firefighter. You're making a difference. You're getting paid, and you better, I always said there was a social contract, an unwritten social contract, and that is you are there to risk your life, and when you return, you're going to have a good job and your family is going to be taken care of. And that was something that was drilled into me by the senior firefighters that I worked with. And that, we also had an expression that you risk a lot to save a lot, and you risk little to save little, and you have to be prudent in all this. But if you're getting into this business to worry about politics, then you're really in the wrong line of business, because there are jobs that are really purely political. This is all about helping people, and as long as you stay focused on that and taking care of your team, taking care of the people that work for you, you can survive the politics, I would say.
Okay, this has been terrific, Mike. I think this will be the longest podcast I've had to date for them being done, but I think we've just scratched the surface in a lot of different topics, and maybe we'll have to have you come back in the future. We'll look at some of these things in a different perspective, maybe leadership in general. So I just want to say thank you to Mike Byrne, Deloitte, for being a guest here on the Disaster Zone podcast.
Well, thank you, Eric. I one of the things I value most about my career in emergency management is the friendships I've developed, and you're at the top of the list. I really value your friendship and your advice over the years and your collegiality. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Mike. And as we've heard today on this podcast, every disaster is an opportunity to learn from it. And my question is, are you creating only lessons observed and not learning from your experiences? I mean, many times we seem to repeat the mistakes of the past. So now, a reminder to everybody, be safe. Think about what you can do to become better prepared for the next disaster. And perhaps it's being more deliberate about learning from past disasters and not repeating the same mistakes in the future. Tune in again soon for more information on all aspects of disasters. You can also check out the Disaster Zone blog at www.disaster-zone.com.